Welcome to On the Brink with Jeff Wefferson. This is episode number 3, being recorded here on Tuesday, the 18th of December, the year of our Lord Obama, 2012. One of the things we're going to talk about in this show is entitled Lost in Time, which is sort of a takeoff on the old science fiction television show Lost in Space from the 1960s. Lost in Time, I think that sort of describes where we are. Humanity as a whole, we don't really have a solid coordinate reference frame for what we call time. It's all very relative, because theoretically, the date could be anything. It could be 8,452,321 after a certain starting point that you wanted to start counting from. So theoretically, it's totally arbitrary. So in this show, we're going to talk about... It's actually the title of probably the first independent research paper I did when I was in college. It's called An Analysis of Sociocultural Variations in the Perception of Time. As it turned out, in college, I either did really well in courses or didn't even go. And my anthropology course was, this is cultural anthropology, it was very interesting, but I ended up not going to class for about a month, but I was very interested in the subject matter, so I asked the professor if I could do a research paper on my own and let my grade for that count as my grade for the whole course, and he agreed. So I took a couple of months and pulled together all this independent research that I'd been doing and wrote the paper, and he was blown away by it. He gave me an A+, and then asked me if I did it all by myself, which I did. So that was really, really cool. That's how education should be. You know, you should be inspired to pursue things on your own and have the freedom to sort of do it in your own way. So anyway, that was my first real foray into a lot of different readings about different sort of outlooks on the origin of our different perceptions of time. A lot of philosophers... Isaac Newton wrote about time a lot. He sort of thought of time as what you might call duration. Other minds have associated with time with change or movement or perhaps evolution. We've got the whole concept of time in the Western mentality seems to involve these concepts of movement, change, evolution. Whereas it's contrasted with the concept of simultaneity, which is no time, or simultaneousness means everything happening at once. So, in other words, I think that our experience of reality has elements of both the linear time as succession of events or duration or movement, but we've also got simultaneous aspects of perception of time. These may be correlated with the right and left cerebral hemisphere functions that Robert Ornstein talked about in his book, The Psychology of Consciousness, which is one of the books I was reading at the time I did this research paper in the late 1970s. So for the show, I thought it would be interesting to contrast Western and non-Western conceptions of time and also talk about not just cultural variations in the perception of time, but the whole concept of calendrical relativity, meaning different cultures' ways of calculating where we are in larger expanses of quote-unquote time, and look at different sort of calendars, specifically the Gregorian calendar, which is the one that we operate under now. I'll also talk about the work of artist, visionary, and Mayan scholar Jose Arguelles, who I met a couple of times, and he was one of the first people to really popularize the whole Mayan calendar in 2012 thing. And then it sort of gained momentum, and it was this giant sort of New Age marketing category there for quite a few years. But then as we've gotten closer to 2012 in the past 2 or 3 or 4 years, it's all the 2012 things pretty much dried up. And then some people forged ahead with things about 2013 and still clinging to the numerical thing of having one number after the next. So, but a lot of people just abandoned the whole thing. I guess they made as much money as they could from selling all their books and DVDs and have moved on to real estate or insurance as they do. But one guy is still doing it. Actually, there's two guys out there that are still doing a lot of reasonably intelligent, quote unquote, 2012 Mayan calendar related stuff. And that's Carl Kalaman from Sweden and John Major Jenkins from Colorado. And so they both have some pretty intelligent things to say, and neither one of them ever bought into the whole idea that's been popularized around the Mayan calendar. A lot of misconceptions about, for example, that it's supposed to mean that it's the end of the world, quote unquote. It's supposed to be associated with any kind of negative events or occurrences or doomsday scenarios of some kind, or things like that. Both of these guys have sort of said that they believe that the whole thing is about, it's a marker in time that the Mayans set up, not to mark a specific event or a specific moment, but a window of time that we've actually been in for quite a long time. And there we go. It's hard to get away from the concept of time. It's about time, isn't it? It is. This show is about time. So the whole idea of there being a moment or a day or an hour when something is going to happen has been prophesied by so many people for so many years about this coming Friday. I just don't really see anything like that happening. The one thing that I would be aware of is the powers that be could have something up their sleeve, like some kind of false flag event involving perhaps a fake alien invasion, where they'll use tropospheric laser holograms projected using HARP and satellite technologies to make people think we're being invaded by aliens, and so they'll freak out and beg the government for even more control in order to protect them. But I don't think anything like that's really going to happen. I don't think that there's going to be any sudden flick of a switch on this Friday that where giant currents of electricity are going to impinge on the Earth, or that the sun's going to be blocked out, or it's going to switch off, or I don't think anything like that's going to happen. I think that we've been in a window of alignment. John Major Jenkins says that we've basically been in the window of alignment of the place where the sun is in the sky now, overlapping with the center of the galaxy, which is called the Hunab Q to the Mayans, that we've basically been in a window of pretty close alignment of that for ever since the 1970s, and that we will be for a few more decades after now. So this whole period of time, it's basically interstellar geometry. If you think of it, if you look at the sort of a three-dimensional diagram of the plane of the galaxy, which is sort of like a disk with a bulge at the middle, and if you look at the plane of our solar system, the plane in which the planets move around the sun, that's basically in the same plane as the disk of the galaxy. And so the geometry of our sun being in alignment with the Hunab Q is very similar to the way that the geometry lines up that creates solar and lunar eclipses. So in a sense, our sun is not only lining up with the center of the galaxy, but it's sort of like eclipsing it, I guess you might say. But since the sun is not a solid block of matter that's going to block out energy, but according to the electric universe plasma theory people, the sun and other stars are not thermonuclear reactors. They're actually more like light bulbs that are being lit up by these giant filaments of electrically conductive plasma that are flowing all through the galaxy and have magnetic fields too. So the sun is like a ball of this energy radiating out the energy that the Mayans and other indigenous cultures believed, and I think that the plasma physicists might think the same thing too, that the energy from the stars is actually originally radiating out from the energy of the Hunab Q, the center of the galaxy. The astronomers tell us that it's something like a giant mega white hole, the opposite of a black hole. A black hole is where everything is sucking into it and you can't see it. A white hole is the opposite. Everything is pouring out of it and radiating out immense amounts of energy. If the center of our galaxy was not largely obscured by clouds of dust, it would be a brilliant object in the sky that would probably create daylight 24 hours a day. But for some magic reason, it's obscured by a lot of interstellar dust, and so it's kind of blocked out. But the energy is there nevertheless. So we've got our sun lining up with, in a direct geometrical line with the center of the galaxy, for better or worse. Who knows what it means? Anyway, back to the concept of time. We've had the Gregorian calendar since, let's see, when did that start? The Gregorian calendar was adopted in the year 1582 by the Romans, and I believe at the time it only had 10 months, and then later on, Julius Caesar and Augustus Caesar each added a couple of months or changed it, so that's where the months of July and August came from. And then, so then we have 12 months. But the whole idea, it's essentially, we're talking astronomical time. This has to do with the diurnal and nocturnal cycles of day and night, which is another way to reckon time. But the astronomical time of the lunar cycle of approximately 28 point something days. So really, and then a solar year is the amount of time that it takes the Earth to return in the same place in its orbit around the sun. So that's about 365 days. But you've got all kinds of different slight variations on this. You've got the sidereal year, which is the amount of time. It's very similar to a solar year, but not exactly the same. And so the Gregorian calendar is the one that's sort of been officially adopted. But I think there's, if you really studied a lot of ancient cultures, you'd see that even today, a lot of them still go by completely different calendars. But it's very interesting. I learned this from Jose Arguez. The word calendar comes from the Roman word calends, that has to do with the collection of taxes. So the Romans originally invented the calendar to keep track of when everyone's taxes were due. So essentially, the Gregorian calendar is a calendar of taxation based on the extraction of money from people systematically in time with the natural cycles of the universe, and imposition of artificial reality, what Jose Arguez liked to call the technosphere. Now, I think he was a very talented person. I think he went kind of pretty far out there in his later years, and a lot of sort of really unbelievable kind of stuff, but I think he did make a lot of major contributions, maybe in sort of a generalized way, in the sense of for some of his earlier work. Like, for example, his very first book called Mandala is really brilliant, and then his more sort of academic work called The Transformative Vision. There's a chapter in there called Art as Internal Technology, which is quite brilliant. Then his book Earth Ascending, which has some really wicked series of 64 charts that he drew that talk that sort of integrate a lot of this information. But after that, he started in with the Mayan factor and started claiming to be a guy called Pakal Votan, who was a Mayan priest from quite a few hundred years ago, and Jose was claiming to be the reincarnation of this guy. But anyway, I think Jose's central biggest contribution is questioning the idea of where calendars come from. And he talked about the different timing frequencies that we're on. He says that the Gregorian timing frequency of Western industrial civilization is what he called 1260, where we've got 12 months out of the year and we've got 60 minutes per hour. But he thought that this timing frequency puts us and our mentality and our whole civilization completely out of harmonious vibration with the more natural timing frequencies of 1320, which is 13 is the number of lunar cycles in one solar year, plus or minus, and 20, I believe, is the number of days in a really important cycle of the Mayan calendar. I'm not sure what the 20 represents to the Mayans. I do know that they had many different sort of calendars that they would use simultaneously. They have a 260-day calendar called the Tzolk'in that was very central to their worldview, and I know that's the length, that's the number of days in a Venusian year, the amount of days it takes Venus to go around the sun. But it's also coincidentally the gestation period for a human being to be born, the number of days in approximately 9 months. So that's a very interesting connection there. But we'll talk about the Mayan calendar and possible significance of December 21st, 2012 and this whole thing in a bit. But in terms of the origin of the Gregorian calendar, I already said about how it came from the Romans imposing taxation. There's a guy named Bishop Usher who, I'm not sure when he actually made this calculation, but he derived all this from his reading a literal interpretation of the sense of time given by the Bible in terms of the length of time that God took to create the universe and the heavens and the earth and all that stuff. And he sort of worked backwards in time with all this stuff and came up with the date 4004 BC as the date that the universe was created. So that's really not that long ago compared to what geological time tells us. Now, that's an interesting way of looking at time. Geological time is all your different epochs, and sort of like an era, sort of like the Cambrian era, or the Permian, or the Silurian, or Devonian, or the Archean, or Hadean. These are the ones way back, like billions of years. Hadean is when the Earth's surface was believed to be very hot. Possibly the Earth would have been much smaller than now, according to the expanding Earth hypothesis. Hadean would have been where possibly the only life forms were cyanobacteria, one of the most interesting life forms, because they still exist today, we believe, in the same form that they were in then. And so they're the only life form that survived the entire history of the Earth, unchanged, able to live anywhere, anaerobic environments with no oxygen, no light, extremes of heat, vacuum, extremes of pressure. They can pretty much live anywhere, and they're inside of us. So it may be that cyanobacteria, sort of like mitochondria, may be sort of like the backbone of life. And they might be the most intelligent life forms because of their extreme longevity and to exist without mutating into something really weird. Anyway, that's the subject for another show. Geological time is very interesting because the people that studied the Earth and the rocks and the subterranean structure of the Earth and all that kind of thing, they were not only the first people to really look at vast expanses of time, they were also the first people to sort of study the whole idea of climate change, because the rocks, the geological structure of the Earth, is sort of a record. It's like a library in which the record of the conditions and movements and changes in the Earth's structure and chemical composition and atmosphere and things like that. All of this information is stored and encoded in the different layers of rock and the different types of rock and the way they've been formed, the way the lava comes out of the volcanoes and the way that the lava magnetizes according to the type of rock, because that sort of encodes and stores a record of how the Earth's magnetic field was at that time. And that's another... See, theoretically, you could measure time in the sense of any kind of repeating cycle. It could be, you could have time based on whenever you come back around to the same point you were from the precession of the equinoxes 26,000 years ago, which some people believe that that's what the 2012 marker is, the lining up of a 5,000 and something year cycle with a 26,000 year cycle. But then again, a cycle is a cycle, and any point in the cycle is theoretically no different from any other point. So you've got to pick a specific point in the cycle for some reason. So that brings us to another whole idea that has to do with how we think of time. Do we think of time as a continuity, or do we think of time as a succession of events? It's sort of like the difference between analog and digital. And again, this may be a reflection of the way that our brains work. We've got this sort of dual functioning thing happening that should really ideally be complementary. But I think in Western civilization, the left hemisphere is more dominant, especially the fact of a reality or worldview, a mental operating environment operating on Western Indo-European languages like English that are extremely linear. We break time into past, present, and future, three discrete categories of time. Whereas there's whole languages and worldviews and ways of living on this planet that whose linguistic structure has no separation between past, present, and future. I have to tell you about the work of a researcher named Benjamin Lee Whorf, who in the 1940s was the first white person to go and live with the Hopi Indians in Arizona. They had never been exposed to the white man's culture before, except maybe by a few visitors, like maybe Frank Waters or somebody like that. He was actually the first person to tell about the Hopi prophecies. His book called The Book of the Hopi. Benjamin Lee Whorf was actually an insurance salesman and an amateur anthropologist. He went to live with the Hopi Indians, and he has a book, an entire book that he wrote about this. But one of the main insights that he derived from his decade or so living with the Hopi was that their language has no tenses. Their language has no division of time into past, present, and future. It's like their whole way of talking about things is everything's in a perpetual now, or an eternal now, in which people or events or objects may be distant from you in space, but they're still now. So, I mean, when you think about it, when you think of what it really means, when you say that, when we're talking about something in English that's not now, then you go, well, when is it? If it's not now, when? And it means that either it exists in memory or it exists now, but somewhere else, physically removed from you in space, but simultaneously existent with you in time. Say, like somebody you know that's alive right now, but they're somewhere else. You know that they exist, and they're alive, and your minds are probably connected telepathically. And this is the subject for another show. The entire real-time network of human consciousness created by all of the brain-mind complexes of all the people that are alive right now, each of their central nervous system ultimate technologies is radiating out the vibrations of their reality, and it all forms a sort of what you might call a noosphere of psychic energy. And this is not even specific to our species, but it sort of blends in with the consciousness and thought awareness energy of all the other life forms, like the larger mammals, like the whales and dolphins, with more advanced brains than we have. And it would merge in with all the mammals and all the life forms and the plants and the birds and the insects and everything in the consciousness field of Mother Earth as a planet, the Gaia noosphere. Our minds are part of this all the time. And so to explore how these realities would experience time would be very interesting, to sort of explore in a shamanic, internal kind of way. So anyway, back to the whole idea of geological time. Geologists have looked back and sort of mapped out all these different eras, but we don't really know for sure if it's really true or not, because we weren't there to measure it. And see, there's a difference between the sort of time that we can reckon in our day-to-day lives. We've got the time of a day. And I'm not talking about looking at your watch or a clock. I'm talking about just your sort of own intuitive, continuous perception of time. You've got the feeling of time passing as you do stuff. The relativity of, like, if you're having a really good time, it goes by fast. And if what you're doing sucks, it seems like it's taking forever. If you're waiting for your loved one to come back, it seems like the clock's almost stopped. But if you're just having a blast, then all of a sudden 5 hours are gone and you didn't even know it. So it's very relative, but we're all familiar with the passing of a day, a morning, an afternoon. The sun comes up, moves across the sky, it gets dark, stars come out, they go across the sky, the sun comes up again. And then we've got the sort of longer scale time that we can see within our lives of sort of a seasonal variation. But what we're talking about with the Mayan calendar and these big scales of time, like geological time, we're talking about cycles that are so big that they're way outside the expanse or awareness of the individual human. So the whole awareness or knowledge of these has to be passed down and encoded in such a way that people can grasp it or experience it or understand it abstractly outside the domain of their own experience. Because as far as I know, no one's lived to be 5,000 years old. I think Ray Kurzweil is going to have a go at it, but he won't be a human being. But and I'd really like to know when he's lived forever, because I'd like to know when forever is up so that he can then say that he's lived forever. No one's around that can remember 26,000 years ago, or when the pyramids were built, or the Sphinx, or the Mayan temples, or anything like that. And even these, all these cultures are gone. We have remnants. We've got the writings and documents that they left, and the artwork and stuff. But I think that there's a lot of leeway in how this stuff is interpreted, because there's been no succession of continuity of what it all means. Now, I may be wrong. There could be, say, like in terms of the traditional Mayan elders, of which I believe that there are some who exist, although there's many different groups claiming to be the traditional Mayan elders, and they've all, most, I'd say the ones that don't have any books or DVDs or fancy colored robes are probably the real ones, probably the ones that we haven't heard of. So who knows what they're saying about all this. I do know that a lot of people have gone down to Mexico right now to be there for whatever it is that's going to happen, but hopefully they think it's just going to be sort of like a celebration of the turning of a giant cycle. But then again, you have to wonder why this specific date was chosen by, and whoever chose it. Why not, you know, 10 years ago or 10 years from now or 100 years ago from now? Because when you look at a cycle of 26,000 years, 100 years is just like, you know, a split second of time. So we've got many, many, many different ways that we look at time and that we experience it. Our experience of time is also related to our function that we call memory, whereby we are able to recall things that aren't happening now. Very interesting to think about, because without memory, would we even have a sense of time? Everything might be a continuous present that was brand new. If you had no memory at all, everything would be unfamiliar. Like, it would be hard to separate out having a conscious experience of being here now only with no memory, because you wouldn't be able to remember that you'd seen anything before. It would all just be sort of like brand new. So maybe one of the big functions of the Mayan calendar and people inscripting their calendrical beliefs and information in stone, because it was important for them for this information to be recorded and to be able to be transmitted again over long expanses of, yes, time, possibly aimed at future beings who may not even speak the language but might be able to sort of decode the reason that these stone monuments and inscriptions are there and make sense out of it. And you'd think that if they went to all this trouble, that it would be for something that was actually important, not for just some abstruse, esoteric, metaphysical reason that if you didn't believe in it, it didn't really matter. And here again, we come to the 2012 thing. Like, people are talking about all these alignments of cycles and stuff like that. This is the beginning of a new creation, the closing of one cycle and the beginning of the next. And you go like, but what does it all really mean? And then there's the sort of the school of people that are sitting there waiting for something to happen, like it's going to be an external event that's going to happen to them rather than something that they're going to make happen on their own. And I liken that to sort of the born-again Christian attitude of doesn't matter what they do. They can just sit around and pick their nose, even sin, but that's okay, because when Jesus comes, he's going to save them if they believe. All they have to do is believe, and I'm not sure what that means. But if they believe, then Jesus is going to save them, and then they'll be raptured up to eternity. And just none of that ever made any sense to me. But there's a surprising amount of people that sort of cling to that kind of ideology. But it's very disempowering, because somebody like that might waste decades of their whole life sitting on their ass watching TV, thinking that just because they've got their contract signed with God, that they're going to be saved without doing anything. And so there's probably a similar faction of the 2012 people who go like, yeah, well, on December 21st, 2012, something's going to happen, and it's going to make everything okay. It's going to correct all the evil karma and cosmic debt that humans have accrued from 5,000 years of living in industrial civilization based on rape of the earth, the genocide of indigenous people, the exploitation of each other and of the earth. They somehow think that an event or a moment in time is going to happen that's somehow going to correct all that, and they don't have to do anything except just like be there for it. I really have a problem with that too. And I think that you'd think that if the universe is a conscious and just place, that if something like that was going to happen, if there was going to be some sort of cosmic event in honor of all that stuff, that it would be horrific. It wouldn't be some kind of cosmic interdimensional rapture where all these people are going to go up to the next level where they can start the trashing of that dimension after they've already parasited this one out of existence. It would be a horrific instantaneous flash of transformation of the whole dimension where they lived into sort of like a burning hellfire or something like that. So, but I'm not saying anything like that's going to happen either, although the people like the U.S. Navy that are operating HARP and the other ionospheric microwave heaters might have conceived of trying to do something like that. And in fact, it's been written in some of the more esoteric chapters on the HARP project that some scientists believe that if they were aiming some of these ionospheric microwaves at the sun, which Gordon J.F. McDonald actually talked about triggering instabilities on the sun in order to trigger these giant cascades of plasma, it could sort of create a feedback loop in which there would be a real-time beam connecting the sun with the earth, and all the energy from the sun would come pouring down through that channel into the earth's atmosphere and burn up the whole atmosphere. There's a guy that actually wrote a book about this. It's called the book, I think it's called The New Millennium or something like that. I want to get a copy and read it. Speaking of other anomalies relating to the whole time thing, I think it's worth mentioning that people talk about the whole idea of time travel. Like they want to travel in time. There was an old science fiction show on TV called The Time Tunnel where they would go into this whirling spiral and come out at any given point. And I think they ended up in 20 million BC in the first show with dinosaurs and stuff. So you've got the concept of time travel, which runs through a lot of science fiction. People talk about regressing into past lives and the whole concept of reincarnation, things like that. Traveling in time, I always tell people that, look, if you stop and think about it, we're traveling in time right now. How could we not be? I mean, maybe time is traveling through us or around us, but time is moving. We're moving through it in our perception every minute of every day. So we all are time travelers at any given point. And as well, we're all also traveling in space, like not just the local space of how far you can reach with your arm or the size of your room or even just our planet, but the Earth is moving through space in many different directions all at once. In fact, it would be hard to know exactly which way we are going because the whole frame of reference depends on what you want to adopt as your frame of reference. I mean, we're twirling around, the whole solar system is twirling around the arm of the galaxy. The galaxy is rotating and then moving itself. And so there's really no absolute frame of reference in the spatio-temporal universe for us to know where we are in space or time. It's all relative. The date that this is could be anything, just depending on who had the authority to foist their temporal hallucination on civilization and make them believe it, in the same way that the Federal Reserve foisted the whole concept of money on us. The Romans foisted the idea of taxation on us with the Gregorian calendar. But we're all travelers in space and time. Even if you're sitting in your chair looking at a computer or listening to me talk on the radio on the computer, we're traveling in space and time as I speak right now. Sort of another person that's interesting to talk about is a guy named Emmanuel Velikovsky, a Russian psychoanalyst who was originally a student of Sigmund Freud. He branched off to start doing his own research, and he became very interested in the sort of a universal story of great planetary catastrophes and disasters, many of which were floods, that permeate the writings of all ancient cultures. And he thought that this lent credence to the belief that these events really did occur, that they weren't just made up in these mythologies. And he started researching that, and his first book was called Worlds in Collision, where he started forming hypotheses for what the causes were behind some of these global catastrophes. Then in another book called Earth in Upheaval, he examines the purely geological evidence for these planetary catastrophes in terms of the geological record of the planet storing or recording these events, like I was talking about before. And he also came up with the idea of what he calls cataclysmic evolution, as contrasted with the Darwinian idea of a long, slow, uniformitarian, gradual process of evolution working by natural selection. Darwin tried to use that to explain why we've got different species of life and stuff like that. But Velikovsky said that, sure, that might be operating, but that a bigger, more potent factor influencing the appearance of new species and the reason that we have the life forms that we do now, he called it cataclysmic evolution, because it had to do with the relatively sudden appearance of these events, sort of like disasters from space, many of which would be sort of like maybe the Earth colliding with an asteroid, passing through the tail of a comet, a meteor hitting the ocean, and then all the repercussions of these, including massive volcanic eruptions, the Earth being tilted off its axis or jolted out of its position in orbit. He theorized that all of these things had not only happened regularly throughout the history of the Earth, but that they had happened, they weren't things of the past, but that things like this had happened in historical times when there were human beings here who had the ability to write or at least share these stories orally. And then in another book, Ages in Chaos, he looked at the cultural traditions and writings that tell of all these sort of things too. So Velikovsky also pointed out that one of his biggest achievements or his biggest contributions to humanity was his questioning of basic and fundamental scientific and religious beliefs that we've held to be true. But he stressed the importance of questioning these and to not be fixated or over-attached to them, but to consider that each one is really meant to be a sort of a working hypothesis. But when something that makes more sense comes along, you should let go of the old belief and consider the new one. And so he drew the scorn, wrath, and criticism of a lot of people when his books started coming out, including astronomer Dr. Carl Sagan, who I have a lot of respect for, but not the fact that he tried to actually prevent some of Velikovsky's books from being printed. I thought that was pretty much of a bullshit thing for him to do. But so anyway, Velikovsky points out that due to massive radiation bombardment from space, that evidence exists that large radiation bombardments can actually sort of reset the whole geological clock of the Earth by changing the rate of decay of radioactive particles, like in carbon-14. So in other words, what he's saying is that a lot of our dates of things from long ago using carbon-14 may be totally inaccurate, because they might have been valid up to a certain point, but then one of these catastrophic radiation events from space could happen and it could reset the whole molecular and radioactive decay rate of all these elements on the planet. And it's like the radiation storm moved the hands of the clock geologically and energetically. And so that's another important way that we believe that we understand the concept of long periods of time is radiocarbon dating, but it's actually quite fallacious. Yet another way that indigenous people have kept track of time is through records of the numbers of generations of families, of ancestors that they've got. And I believe some of the indigenous people of where I am here in Western Victoria, in Garry Ward National Park, their ancestry goes back over 4,000 generations, which is probably, 100,000 years, I guess. So that's another very interesting way of reckoning long periods of time, as well as honoring your the ancestry that we come from too. In addition to looking at concepts of time as duration, movement, and change, and astronomical time, sidereal time, generations, and things like that, it's as opposed to expanses of time, it's interesting to look at what we might think of as specific moments in time or events, because you'd think that if you look at just sort of day-to-day experience, there aren't really that many specific events that could be used as markers. I mean, you've got, for example, you've got the moment that the sun comes up each day, the moment that it goes down. You've got the moment that the moon comes up, the moment that the moon goes down. You've got the moments that the sun crosses the meridian, which is sort of a line going through the sky that connects the north and the south. So it's like the midpoint of your sky, not the zenith, but the meridian is the line. Zenith is the high point above you. All these are sort of virtual markers, but I thought that there's a couple of things that signify events that could be used as sort of long-term calendrical markers for advanced societies that wanted to do something like this. And one of them would be what's called the heliacal rising of a star or planet. For example, the Egyptian New Year is on July 23rd, which is the day of the heliacal rising of the star Sirius. That means that's the day that the star Sirius can be seen to rise with the sun, but when it's far enough away from the sun to actually be seen. Because what before that, for 70 days, Sirius has been so close to the sun that you can't see it. So then on July 23rd, it suddenly is far enough from the sun to be seen as a separate star. So that was an event, a celestial event that the Egyptians thought was very significant. They thought it was significant enough for it to represent the beginning of their new year. And another cosmic event that would be a very interesting way of marking time or a window of time would be eclipses, like of the sun and the moon. Because it represents an eclipse is not really a moment, but it's a window of time. And you've got the window of time defined by the beginning and the end of the partial phase. And then if it's a total eclipse, you've got the even more powerful, shorter window of time during the totality phase, which might be, you know, an hour or so for a total lunar eclipse, or up to 7 minutes for a total solar eclipse. So these are other ways that our whole conception of time has come into being. Now there's another interesting concept that relates to our experience of time, and it's the concept of eternity. Now what exactly would eternity be? Eternity means forever. It means it's beyond time. It would be always. So again, it sounds stupid to try to talk about eternity in words, but would eternity be a cycle or a vast unending expanse of space and time? Theoretically, a circle having no beginning or end would be eternal. So again, we're up against the fact that for the purposes of this radio show and for the purposes of any kind of talking using the English language, what we run up against is the built-in structure and limitations of the way that the specific language that we use structures reality itself. And if you look at the history of English, it would be really interesting to see how our whole idea of tenses has come about. But we do, if you step back and look at it, we really do use the three divisions of past, present, and future without even thinking about it. It's like a built-in part of our whole way that we encode and structure our reality, but it's not necessarily the way that reality really is. I mean, reality really is one unbroken whole. And so our language, English language and other Western Indo-European languages, tend to fragment and break up reality into units and symbolize them with words. But these words are more like maps that we often might confuse with the territory itself. You've also got the difference between what you might call harmonic languages, which are a lot of the ancient languages like ancient Chinese, Egyptian, ancient Hebrew, Sanskrit, for example, Tibetan. These ancient languages were never written down. They were spoken, but they weren't meant to be used as maps. They were more like music, because the harmonic languages were about the vibratory power of the spoken word. Whereas English and other Indo-European languages are what you call symbolic languages, based on words that are symbols, arbitrary symbols or sounds that or written patterns that stand for things. For example, in a harmonic language, the sound for tree would probably have some kind of vibrational isomorphism with a tree. Like if you could translate the basic pattern of what a tree is, translate that into sound, that would be the word for sound. I mean, the word for tree in a harmonic language. Whereas in English or other symbolic languages, it's completely arbitrary about what word means what. The word tree, who knows where that came from, but I don't see any direct relationship between that which makes all trees similar and the word tree. It could be hoogly-doogly-dumpfly-morph. If that's what if we all agreed that that meant tree, then that's what it would mean. So that's why symbolic languages are very arbitrary, and they're just like it's sort of like the difference between a harmonic language and a symbolic language is like the difference between music and cartography. So in a way, we'd probably be a lot better off if we used harmonic languages, because it would be more like singing with each other rather than sharing maps with each other and having the possibility that the map could be confused with the territory or misinterpreted, or that the map might be improperly drawn or something like that. Now, something else I thought that would be interesting to talk about is some of the concepts of really long periods of time that we've got. And the longest one that I know about, and it relates to what might be happening with the Earth and humanity right now, it's a concept from the Hindus. It's called a yuga, Y-U-G-A. And I don't pretend to be an expert on any of this stuff. And then different people give different sort of information. And I don't think it's really important to assign any specific number of years to a yuga or anything like that. But the basic idea is that there's, you know, like we've got seasons of a year, sort of like in your more temperate climate zones of the planet, you've got fall, winter, spring, and summer, and they sort of gradually change into each other, and sometimes you might have aspects of each in a different season. It can be cold in summer, it can be hot in winter, and all of these things. But in general, you've got sort of a flow and a gradual transition between these seasons, and then it comes back around and repeats the cycle again. Well, the yuga is a similar idea, but for much larger expanses of time, on the order of tens or possibly hundreds or maybe even millions of years per yuga or per galactic season. And there's sort of different ways of breaking it down, but the basic idea is that there may be these large-scale seasons operating that we're a part of and have always been, and that could explain the difference in the quality of energy and time that we're experiencing. For example, a lot of people seem to think that where we are right now in this big cycle would be coming to the end, or maybe in the middle, and hopefully not the beginning, but somewhere in the yuga called the Kali Yuga. That's K-A-L-I. Kali was the Hindu goddess of death and destruction. The Kali Yuga was the shortest but darkest of the seasons, sort of like the winter. It was the age of darkness and the age of war and killing, the age of machines. If they call it the Iron Age, the age of materialism, when humanity has sunk down to its lowest common denominator, and where we've totally, as a whole, lost complete touch with our true spiritual nature, and we think that matter in the material world is all that really exists, and the whole idea of mind and spirit and consciousness is just sort of a hallucination or a fable. And that very much describes the world of today. So a lot of people have thought that we may be coming to the end of the Kali Yuga, but it's hard to say. I mean, to me, it doesn't look like things are getting any better in the sense of a lot of people think that there's more people waking up and stuff, but now that they're, not only is their bed on fire, their body is on fire. Their feet and hands are burning because they've been asleep for so long, and all this weird shit is flaring up around us in the world. And I'm talking about stuff that humans are doing. Human advanced technologies aimed at ourselves. All our most advanced technologies are weapon systems. And there's many different overlapping things. We've got entire paradigms of environmental warfare using things like HARP and chemtrails, genetic engineering. Oh my God, just a whole spectrum of everything. We all, unless you've got your head in the sand, you've got to be aware of a lot of this stuff. I don't see it getting any better. In fact, I see it getting a lot worse really quickly in terms of humanity's relationship with the earth, which is the real frame of reference of meaning, because what we do to ourselves within the human mind, it could be anything. I mean, it's our reality that's just human is nothing more than a hallucination that we all share, more or less. So it's the effect that we're having on the other living beings of this planet, Mitukaye or Yasin, as the Lakota would say, all my relations. It's our effect on the larger matrix of life, the web of life, our family of life, and our fellow beings. That's the real frame of reference from which we have to gauge the relevance or meaning of what we're doing. And it doesn't matter what we say or think or believe within our own silly little human minds. So if you look at what we're doing to the earth, it's actually completely negative. It's like a horrific nightmare of what our civilization is wreaking on this planet right now. So it seems like that what's happening now does fit the description of the Kali Yuga really well. But if so, it's hard to know exactly where we are in it. Anyway, to sum it all up, I'm just going to read from a page on the web about the 2012 Mayan calendar thing that I think has some interesting insights in terms of giving us a way to think about all this that might be of value for people who really do care about what it means to be here now. Because now is where we are. It's really always now. And we're here. This rapidly approaching December 21st, 2012, synchronization date can be understood as an alignment of vast timing cycles, both celestial and planetary in nature, that was recorded precisely to alert us of the potent opportunity of these times we are now living through. The Maya say we'll be entering the fifth world. The Aztecs call it the dawning of the sixth sun. By whatever name, we are approaching the turning of world ages, and every single one of us is an essential player in these planetary moments. What does it mean that a world age is closing and preparing to regenerate? How can we consciously shift in harmony with the grand changing of cycles? What new evolutionary possibilities can we meet on the other side of this threshold? The more deeply we contemplate these questions from our hearts, the more receptive we can become to living the answers and consciously surrendering to this vast evolutionary process underway as it unfolds through us. This 12/21/12 synchronization date can inspire us to make positive changes and alignments in our lives. As we near the closing of this cycle, it is key that we look at our own lives and ask, what is seeking to be resolved? What is in need of healing? What is seeking forgiveness? What amends can be made to be in right relationship? What baggage, both physically and emotionally, can be let go of now that we don't need to carry into the new era. As the Mayan timekeepers say, Earth herself is transitioning into a new cycle. This really makes it more essential than ever that we attune to the living process and potential of transformation on all levels. So too, we must find new ways to heed the calls to align our human lives and culture in harmony with the biosphere. So as always, I would say that having been looking at all this for several decades, being here now is all that we ever can really do. We're going to have December 21st, 2012 here in 3 days, but it doesn't really matter because if you've been on your highest path, you've been here now the whole time. But I think that it's really important that we realize that we each are the ultimate technology, that we each have an enormous amount of creativity as our divine right as human beings, and that I think we should each make a concerted effort to live simply so that others may simply live, because most of what we have as members of Western civilization, we don't need it. We could live much more simply and have everything that we need to be happy, healthy, and whole without being so greedy and taking so much from the earth and being so stupid and destructive. So rejoice and give thanks that we're here now and gravity is still free and oxygen. We've got friends, we've got Mother Earth, we've got the whales and dolphins and the people of one heart. So let us all use this cosmic moment in time, this sacred moment in time, as a moment of celebration and giving thanks to Mother Earth and the universe and the Great Spirit for giving us all the gift of life, and that we've all got each other on this planet, and that it's up to us what's going to happen next. Thank you for listening, and tune in again next week. The humpback whale sounds you've been hearing in the background are songs of the eastern humpback whale recorded by the Oceania Project, Wally and Trish Franklin and Mark. And we thank you so much for letting us use these whale sounds. And thanks to the whales and dolphins for being our friends. Thanks for letting us live on your planet.
At the time, I'm going to close.